Pot Stir Podcast, where politics, religion, and history collide, and it's not always polite. I'm your host, Jay Poole. Thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to part two of Moralism Without Sacrifice, the two-parter discussing the abortion issue. If you haven't yet listened to part one, stop right here and listen to part one. You'll want to listen to that episode first before listening to this episode. Part one will give you the context you'll need to fully understand part two. So with that out of the way, let's just jump right into part two. Late Moral Majority Leader Jerry Falwell said in 2005 that the origins of the religious right came from the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, where he decided upon hearing about the decision that evangelical Christians needed to begin organizing. But that's revisionist history. At the time of the Roe v. Wade decision, there was no widespread outrage regarding the decision. Among evangelicals, the reactions were largely muted and mixed. The Baptist press even wrote about their support for Roe. This was before views on the abortion issue were some kind of litmus test for one's salvation. As a matter of fact, throughout most of the 1970s, there was very little organized push from evangelicals toward outlawing abortion. Falwell and late Heritage Foundation founder Paul Weyrich joined forces in the mid-1970s, not over abortion or some other apparent sign of moral decay in America, but over support for racial segregation in private Christian colleges, in opposition to the government pulling funding from such schools. Listen to episode 8 for more details on that. Now, Falwell and Weyrich wanted to build a nationwide Republican coalition based on conservative ideology. You see, up until the late 70s, early 80s, the Republican and Democratic parties were largely non-ideological. There were liberals, moderates, and conservatives in both parties. And up until that time, parties were largely based on coalitions that often had disparate interests, and the parties would attempt to cater to these groups. For the most part, this worked quite well, though occasionally conflicts would cause internal splits temporarily, such as the progressive Bull Moose Party, who split from Republicans in the 19-teens, and the segregationist Dixiecrats, who split from the Democrats in 1948. But in general, the parties were not ideological. Democrat Franklin Roosevelt sent Japanese Americans to internment camps during World War II, and Republican Richard Nixon pursued trade relations with China and expanded race-based affirmative action programs stateside. So what Falwell and Weyrich were pursuing, the idea of a conservative-branded Republican Party, was actually pretty revolutionary. But these men felt that they needed an issue that could be marketed to conservative white Americans more generally, as they felt an explicitly racial angle would only appeal to certain regions of the country. To them, abortion had more potential as a national issue. And the abortion issue as the cornerstone of what would become the Moral Majority and later the religious right more generally began its cultivation in 1978. It doesn't take 5 years to take action on a moral imperative, except when it's not a moral imperative at all. The movement against legalized abortion, along with the pushing of the American Center further to the right, has led to the Hyde Amendment, which disallows federal funding to go toward abortion services, and several states instituting measures to curtail abortion within the past 3 decades. These measures have included parental notification laws, mandatory counseling, waiting periods, and mandated ultrasounds. In recent years, some states have passed restrictive laws on clinics and doctors who perform abortions that have resulted in the closure of many abortion clinics. As of 2014, 39% of women of childbearing age lived in a county without an abortion clinic. All of these have the effect of women who have made up their minds to end their pregnancies being delayed or denied the ability to follow through on their decision, making an already difficult decision even harder. The pro-life movement has also worked outside official government channels in opposition to abortion rights. Over the decades, thousands of demonstrations have taken place in front of abortion clinics, complete with gory signs depicting aborted fetuses, not all of which are real. And over the past decade or so, pro-life groups have begun to open up their own clinics aimed at pregnant women who are seeking information and help, steering them away from abortion and oftentimes toward options such as adoption. A few have been radicalized by the pro-life movement's abortion is murder narrative and have murdered doctors who performed abortions, shot up abortion clinics, and committed other terror attacks in the name of saving unborn lives. The most famous of these homegrown terrorists is Eric Rudolph, the Olympic Park bomber who also bombed two abortion clinics and a gay bar. Rudolph stated that the motive for the Olympic Park bombing in 1996 during the Atlanta Games was to confound, anger, and embarrass the Washington government in the eyes of the world for its abominable sanctioning of abortion on demand. Of course, most pro-life Americans and the movement is not violent, and the vast majority act out their support for the movement peacefully. But one of the more troubling aspects of today's pro-life movement in the United States that I do want to touch on is this co-opting of Black Lives Matter and the civil rights struggle of Black Americans generally to push an anti-abortion narrative that demonizes the very people they claim to want to save. One of the most insidious examples of this tact is an incident that happened in 2011. In New York City, the Dallas-based pro-life group Life Always posted a billboard with a young Black child which stated, "The most dangerous place for an African American is in the womb." While the billboard was later taken down due to public outrage, it's a message that I've heard elsewhere since. Not so much to actively support Black people or the Black community, but it's said to silence Black Americans and others who point to the persistent racial disparities, enduring segregation, police brutality, the rise of white supremacist terror groups, and other issues facing Black Americans. The statement highlights the higher abortion rates for Black Americans than other groups. A key figure in this arm of the pro-life movement is Alveda King, who is the niece of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Alveda King had made the argument that Martin Luther King would be pro-life, and that when his wife Coretta Scott King accepted an award on behalf of her husband from Planned Parenthood, it was done with no understanding of what Planned Parenthood was actually about. But in fact, Dr. King did understand what Planned Parenthood was about and wrote a speech in 1966 that his wife delivered. In part, his speech stated, "For the Negro, therefore, intelligent guides of family planning are a profoundly important ingredient in his quest for security and a decent life. There are mountainous obstacles still separating Negroes from a normal existence. Yet one element in stabilizing his life would be an understanding of and easy access to the means to develop a family related in size to his community environment and to the income potential he can demand. The Negro constitutes half the poor of the nation. Like all poor, Negro and white, they have many unwanted children. This is a cruel evil they urgently need to control. There is scarcely anything more tragic in human life than a child who is not wanted. That which should be a blessing becomes a curse for parent and child. There is nothing inherent in the Negro mentality which creates this condition. Their poverty causes it. When Negroes have been able to ascend economically, statistics reveal they plan their families with even greater care than whites. Negroes of higher economic and educational status actually have fewer children than white families in the same circumstances." The speech goes on to state, "Negroes were once bred by slave owners to be sold as merchandise. They do not welcome any solution which involves population breeding as a weapon." Like many pastors of the time, Dr. King was not against abortion and considered his award from Planned Parenthood one of his most prized possessions. While Evita King is entitled to her opposition to abortion and the sharing of her own experiences regarding abortion, it seems improper to co-opt her uncle's memory and twist the facts of his life and viewpoints for the sake of perpetuating the Save the Black Babies movement. The Save the Black Babies narrative, on top of twisting the legacy of the dead, demonstrates the problem with classifying abortion as murder, which, as I discussed in part one, is without merit. The abortion is murder narrative leads us here, to the point of perpetrating stereotypes of Black women as being sexually promiscuous, irresponsible, and lacking in self-control. The Jezebel stereotype of Black women, which dates back to slavery and even prior to slavery, and was used to justify the rape of slave women and girls. The Save the Black Babies movement is counterproductive to the goal of reducing or ending abortion, as it paints Blacks as savage murderers of our young and refuses to address the very reasons why a disproportionate number of abortions are performed on Black women. The Save the Black Babies movement has no interest in the lives of Black babies after they have exited the wombs of their mothers. I asked a question in part one. Does the pro-life movement truly want to save the lives of the unborn? My issue with the pro-life movement has been my one opinion on the issue that has been consistent for the last 20 years. Much of the movement insists that any solution has to be on their terms, outlawing abortion, even if outlawing abortion won't actually save lives. And the movement has gone to the point of lending its support to morally reprehensible individuals and groups, such as Donald Trump, Roy Moore, and the alt-right, for this singular goal. But at the end of the day, the vast majority of pro-choice and pro-life people would like to see fewer abortions. And since the late 1980s, the number of abortions has declined from over 1.5 million per year to just under 1 million in 2014, the last year I have statistics for. That includes declines in liberal meccas, such as California and New York. Making a practice illegal does not make it go away. It hasn't worked for the drug war. And I would imagine that most pro-life Americans would surely understand that. And while the Bible does not equal the unborn life to the life that takes breath, we should be able to acknowledge that the unborn fetus is not just a clump of cells. It is a living being. That's why in most cases, abortion is not a happy occasion, but a decision that is generally difficult and deliberate. That is why some women who choose abortion do regret it. Of course, some don't, but it is generally not arrived at haphazardly. I want to talk about alternatives and solutions that could reduce abortions, but first it would be helpful to talk about why some women choose abortion. I decided to go with the 2004 Guttmacher Institute survey because both pro-life and pro-choice advocates tend to use this survey to make their arguments. The survey was of respondents who had abortions and allowed them to choose one or more reasons for having an abortion. 1,160 women agreed to be surveyed and provided at least one reason. Most gave more than one, and the median was four. Two of the top reasons were, having a baby would dramatically change my life, at 74%, and can't afford a baby now, at 73%. Coercion, a partner or husband wanting these women to have an abortion was 14%, parents wanting the abortion was 6%. Rape and incest were the lowest at 1% and less than 5%, respectively. But some of the most enlightening data was the in-depth interviews with the women surveyed. It offers a glimpse into the minds of women seeking abortion. I'll read a couple of these. This one comes from a 19-year-old below the poverty line. "Well, I already had one son, and right now he's growing up without a father, just me and him. If you ain't got a lot of help with the family support, it's really hard. Sometimes I can't handle it, but I have to, you know, for my son's sake. I believe right now I'm going to take care of myself and my son. Another statement came from a 21-year-old with one child who was also below the poverty line. If you think about it, okay, I get pregnant. I might not be financially stable. I got to take somebody's working money for welfare. You know what I'm saying? Why not let me get out of the situation so I can better myself so when I do get pregnant and have another baby, I don't have to take your money because you're working. I'm not going to be working because I'm going to be sitting on my welfare taking care of my baby. Why? The reasons why women decide to have abortions are often complex. The situation should be as comprehensive as the issues they are trying to solve. Before we get into solutions, I want to briefly talk about an option that is often brought up as an alternative to abortion, adoption. Adoption is a wonderful option. I have some partiality towards it because I grew up in a family built in part through adoption. Adoption offers a child whose parents are unable to care for him or her the opportunity to be raised in a family who is more equipped to do so. Yes, it is a wonderful option, but it assumes that all placements are successful and that if abortion ended and more children were born, all children in need of a stable home will find one. But unfortunately, that is not true, because even with abortion currently legal, there are way more children that need to be adopted than there are adoptive families willing and able to adopt them. According to the Adoption Network, 135,000 children are adopted each year, while 428,000 children are in foster care. 37% of adopted children are non-Hispanic white, while 73% of adopted parents are non-Hispanic white. A child born healthy, able-bodied, without any special needs, and Caucasian has the highest demand. Children who have special needs or behavioral issues are much less likely to be adopted and more likely to end up in foster care. And non-whites, especially black babies, are particularly difficult to place. This is due to a number of factors, including the disproportionately high number of black babies put up for adoption, coupled with the comparatively fewer black adoptive families available, as well as that some white families choosing adoption are uncomfortable with the idea of adopting a black child, oftentimes because, like many families, they want a child who will blend in with their family. According to NPR's Race Card Project, adoption fees tend to be lower for black babies than non-black babies, and the time to adopt shorter, in part to encourage their adoption. But even with these incentives, many black babies do not get adopted, and many end up in foster care, which, like many social services, gets little funding and support. More than 60% of children placed in foster care spend 2 to 5 years before they are adopted, and some are never adopted. The realities of adoption, particularly for black children, put into sharp relief the ignorance of the Save the Black Babies movement. So what can we do to reduce the number of abortions in the United States even further? Economics matter, and in the United States, the wealth gap is growing every day. And the current GOP tax bill that was passed by Congress will only make this worse. Add that in with the continued attacks on healthcare access and affordability for middle-class and poor Americans, and the proposed changes to student loans that will make it even more difficult to find relief, and it is a recipe for disaster. Poor women with unplanned pregnancies will likely find the situation even more impossible. Poverty will create more instability in couples who find themselves expecting, and fewer families will find it financially feasible to adopt. Alleviating poverty isn't just about stuff. It's about both having the necessities that support a healthy life and the resources to work toward improving one's situation. We need to stop fretting about OMG socialism and support public assistance, universal health care, fully funded education, and a living wage. Austerity runs counter to truly pro-life outcomes. There's also something we as a society need to address that is related to both the economic and non-economic reasons why women choose abortion. The best way I can put it is this. Our socially conservative culture does not support a consistent ethic of life. In America, too many parents don't want to teach their girls and boys about sex education because they're afraid teaching them gives them license to engage in sex at an early age. In America, we allow employers to deny contraception coverage to their employees because birth control is against their conscience. In America, we still do not have fully paid maternity and paternity leave. In America, daycare is often the cost of a day's wages. In America, we still stigmatize single parenthood, especially single motherhood, and we condemn rather than support. In America, we think that fixing poverty comes down to requiring marriage rather than actually fixing poverty. In America, access to mental health services rests on a foundation of thoughts and prayers. In America, we cut funding to social services for children and families because personal responsibility. In America, we say we care about life from womb to tomb, but not enough to want the taxes we pay every single year to go towards preserving it. That, my friends, is moralism without sacrifice. Check out our website today, potswearerpodcast.com, for previous episodes, special presentations, announcements, merch, and all things Pot Stirrer Podcast. You can find our show on iTunes, Google Play, and most other podcatchers. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, give us 5 stars, leave a review, share, and tell your friends. Thank you for listening and supporting Pot Stirrer Podcast. I'm Jay Poole. Let's fight for America's future, because freedom is not free.